technology, and economics in the modern world.
Hi, this is Guy Raz from NPR. You may have heard the TED Radio Hour on WLRN last summer. Now, a brand new TED Radio Hour is on the way. Starting this July, join me each Saturday at 2 p.m. for a journey through fascinating ideas and new ways to think and create, based on riveting TED Talks from the world's most remarkable minds. It's the TED Radio Hour with me, Guy Raz, each Saturday afternoon at 2, starting in July, here on WLRN.
And we return. It is today's Topical Currents, Monday edition. Joseph Cooper along with Bonnie Berman. Well, the South Florida population certainly feels the impact of tourism. It's still our biggest contributor to the economy and has been since the late 1800s. In the 21st century, world tourism has burgeoned, not only in destinations, but in specialties. Joining us now is journalist Elizabeth Becker. She's a former senior editor at NPR, and her latest book is Overbooked, The Exploding Business of Travel and Tourism. And Elizabeth Becker joins us from NPR in Washington. Welcome, Elizabeth.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Thanks for joining us. So travel and tourism is arguably the largest global industry in the world, you say, and the world's biggest employer. What are the statistics exactly?
Well, this past full year, 2012, travel and tourism contributed $6.4 trillion, that's trillion with the T, dollars to the global economy. It employs, 1 out of 11 people around the world, the biggest employer by a long shot. And last year broke all records with 1 billion foreign trips. That's doubled since 1995 when it was 500 million and we had full open borders at the end of the Cold War. So that's doubling in size. And those are only foreign trips. If you add in the trips made within countries, it could be as many as 3 billion trips.
Historically, the term tourism, when did it develop? I don't know, before it was called excursions.
It comes from the English, and they were the original hardy tourists. They did the tours of the continent from their island country. They were in search of the oldest civilizations of Rome and Greece, and they forced themselves to stop in France along the way. And that's when the French figured that there was money to be made from these people. And that's when tourism started.
And then you say something happened after World War II in France when they were in economic ruin. How did the U.S. get involved?
This is one of the most surprising aspects of my research. We all know the Marshall Plan, and it was a centerpiece for the American strategy to revive Europe, particularly the Europe that was not going to be under the Soviet Empire, and to revive it and get it back on its feet and keep it in our camp. So when the planners sat down with the French, they came to the conclusion that the best way to get France back on the feet was to revive the tourism industry. And at that stage, the Americans were known as being wiser in tourism than the French, and they had hoteliers come over to the United States from Paris to teach them about plumping pillows and having bedside tables with lamps and things like that. And of course, since then, the French have just run circles around everybody, including us.
So that's what made them the New York Yankees of tourism.
What is it about France that it attracts so many visitors each year, more than the U.S. combined, well, all the U.S.?
It's their incredible arrogance about their culture. If I can just do it in one sentence.
Which Americans find to be a trouble.
Yes, but that's why they have built their tourism industry around themselves. They use tourism to enrich and protect what is French and what is French culture. So people go to France because they want to be French for a week or two. And they're not going to find look-alike resorts. They're not going to find cement skyscrapers on the beach. They're going to go to Provence and drink rosé and smell the lavender. They're going up to Normandy and having Calvados, and they're going to Paris and eating better than they'll ever eat again in their life. They'll go to the Alps and ski. They are going to encounter the old, you know, the essence of France. And the reason is the French government has used every aspect of the culture to do this. The Ministry of Agriculture is as important to tourism as the Ministry of Culture, the Ministry of Transportation, and on and on and on. But this,
I wonder if that old black and white photo of Brigitte Bardot had anything to do with it in the 50s.
Well, that is French, isn't it?
Yes.
No, I mean, you just hit it, you know, that's it. They're going to remain French, and you can see French movies there, and it's not entirely Hollywood movies like in a lot of countries. And Brigitte Bardot rises again.
So if the travel industry is so huge, why doesn't the U.S. have a Department of Tourism like it does a Department of Energy or Agriculture?
It turns out to be a political question you just asked.
Okay.
The United States was reluctant, first of all, to see travel and tourism as one sector. They measured with our GDP when we started measuring GDP in the 30s. There was the hotel sector, train sector, then later the airline sector, and they were very reluctant to make a separate travel and tourism sector. They said, no, that doesn't exist. So we had America has that kind of, you know, we do things sort of freelancing. Then we started to do travel and tourism through the government as a promotional office within the Department of Commerce and in cooperation with the State Department to have the embassies help foreigners come into the U.S. Embassy wherever and figure out their trips so that you had a travel consultancy there and help them with visas and things like that.
Right.
Then in the early 90s, when the Republicans made history by winning the majority in the House of Representatives, then Speaker Newt Gingrich said, as part of the contract with America and as part of their attempt to make a smaller government, they were going to take the U.S. out of tourism. Now, that's a very hard thing to do because any government is very important because the government gives the visas, the government figures out border policies, and the government figures out all the policies that will affect tourism. But this was a philosophical point of view. So the Republicans passed a law that zeroed out this tourism agency within the Department of Commerce.
And nothing's been done to reinstate it?
Well, this was, because this is the United States and we have this contact sport called politics, this was the same time that then-President Clinton and then-Vice President Gore held a White House conference on travel and tourism, what was the first and it turns out to be the last, to say this should be smart government and this will be the 21st century industry and we have a beautiful country and let's go. And they lost. So, and it became a dividing point between Republicans and Democrats. So that held sway and was completely underlined after 9/11. After 9/11 and the attacks in New York and Washington and Pennsylvania, understandably, national security became very important, and a lot of changes were made, including changes at our border and visas. Now, I was in the New York Times Bureau at the time covering national security. A lot of us were thrown into it then. And I can tell you none of us thought about the effect this would have on tourism. But as it turns out, it pretty much put tourism, American tourism, flattened out so that over the next decade we lost $94 billion in revenue and about $16 billion in taxes because people stopped coming because they couldn't stand the way they were treated at the borders. It's not that people didn't love the United States anymore, it's just that it was so hard to get there. And that remained the case until President Obama was elected, and one of his first trips overseas was to Copenhagen, where he and his wife Michelle were going to plead the case of Chicago for the Summer Olympics. The new president, who was incredibly popular then in Europe, which is not the case today, he thought he had it in the bag. He went in to talk to the committee, and he found the opposite. The members of the committee said, sorry, we're afraid that some of the people who want to visit, the foreigners, are going to be stopped at your border, and even maybe the athletes. So Chicago was the first one thrown out, and Rio de Janeiro eventually won. Brazil eventually won. So President Obama said, we can't afford to lose all this. So with his senior aide, Valerie Jarrett, and then working with Department of Commerce and Department of State, he's opening up a lot more consulates in countries like China and Brazil. He's they're working on visas. And as you know, Penny Pritzker was just named his new commerce secretary, and of course she's got travel and tourism all in her background. The family owns the Hyatt Hotels and Royal Caribbean Cruise Lines, based right there in Miami.
Yes. Well, we're going to get to some of these forms of travel, including the cruise lines, when we come back. We're speaking with Elizabeth Becker. She's an award-winning author and journalist, former New York Times correspondent, and she was senior editor at NPR. Name of the book is Overbooked. We'll be back.
This is Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN, South Florida's NPR news station, and NPR for the Florida Keys, 91.5 WKWM. 88 degrees, mostly cloudy skies currently in Miami.
Hi, I'm Robin Young.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson.
We are the hosts of NPR's Here and Now, now heard Monday through Thursday at 2 p.m.
It's a news magazine designed to keep you up to date with the day's news.
And introduce you to amazing people far from the headlines.
It's Here and Now with Jeremy Hobson, that's me.
And Robin Young.
That's her.
Monday through Thursday at 2 p.m. here on South Florida's NPR news station, 91.3 WLRN.
And NPR for the Florida Keys, 91.5 WKWM.
The Carl Gables United Church of Christ Community Arts Program Summer Concert Series continues 8 p.m. Thursday, July 11th with guitarist Pepe Romero. Hailed by the New York Times for his orchestral power, Romero's recital spans the Renaissance through the 20th century and includes music of his father, Celedonio. The series also brings the Brubeck Brothers Quartet, the Alan Baylock Jazz Orchestra, and John Pizzarelli. Tickets and info at 305-448-7421 and communityartsprogram.org.
You can find Topical Currents on Facebook, a dedicated page with daily program descriptions, links to our guests, authors, and books. Facebook.com/topicalcurrents.
And 20 minutes past 1 o'clock, it is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper along with Bonnie Berman, and we're joined by journalist Elizabeth Becker. We're talking about her book, Overbooked: The Exploding Business of Travel and Tourism. Tell me, Elizabeth, this business of medical travel for cheaper surgeries. I've known a few people who've gone to Mexico for a facelift, but what other kind of surgeries are people going out of the country to receive?
Very serious and expensive surgeries here in the United States. As you said, before it was, everybody presumed it was mostly faceless in Mexico or Brazil. And then later, dentistry was catching on, and particularly in Mexico, and I have an example of that in my book. Then pharmaceuticals in Canada. And they all are expression of the rising cost of healthcare in the United States. And ministries of tourism and ministries of health around the world immediately picked up on it. So in Asia, Southeast Asia, South Asia, you have ministries of tourism and ministries of health who will offer you a vacation package for major internal surgeries, birthing even, and it will include your airplane ticket. You fly over, you have your surgery, you recuperate at a hotel or on the beach, you go home, and you will have paid a fraction of the cost you would have paid in the United States. And when you buy that ticket and you look at the package, you'll see the name of the medical people who will be working on you, and they'll tell you what their credit accreditation is. They tend to obviously use the doctors with foreign credentials, particularly European. And they are using this as one of their biggest push for increasing tourism.
I know of friends who just went to Costa Rica to get all their dental work done. It was a fraction.
I'd be a little scared about going to Vietnam for an appendectomy or something.
Oh, the Vietnamese aren't there. This is when I say Southeast Asia, it's more Bangkok, Kuala Lumpur, and Singapore. And they have extraordinary modern hospitals that rival anything in the United States. Bangkok has been doing this for quite a while. And India, I mean, I think you all know many Asian doctors in the United States. I mean, they've had an extraordinary medical profession anyhow. And now that you've combined it with tourism, it's crazy. I mentioned a Texas truck driver who went to Asia to have a major operation. That's how deep within the culture that it's getting. The message is getting out.
I want to go back to cruise ships because you mentioned Royal Caribbean and we have Carnival here, and we're such a large mecca for cruise ships in South Florida. You say one way to not do tourism is a cruise vacation, yet it's the fastest growing segment of the industry. So how do these ships evade U.S. environmental and labor laws, and what are the repercussions?
Well, this was one of this is the Florida story. It's not just South Florida. Miami is the center of the cruise industry in the world. Right there in Miami, you have the headquarters of 2/3 of the cruise industry.
Plus, there's Port Everglades too in Fort Lauderdale.
Right, you have the ports, but the actual headquarters of Royal Caribbean and Carnival are there, and they are the whole story of modern cruise ships, and they. The Ted Arison, you know, father of Mickey Arison, sort of pioneered it. And what he did very cleverly, he comes from an Israeli family that was in shipping long before he moved to Florida. So he it was sort of in his background. He got here to Miami and figured out how to turn a regular ship into a fun ship. You know that story. But what he did politically was he got Congress to agree that he could register his ships as if it were a merchant marine ship, and therefore flag and register the ship overseas and avoid American environmental and labor laws, and also a good chunk of taxes, corporate taxes. So you have a floating hotel that's treated like a merchant marine ship, and does not have to worry about all the water and sewage safe things that that a regular hotel in Miami would have to worry about. Doesn't have to worry about the taxes, a good chunk of the taxes, and doesn't have to worry about labor costs. So that, and in my book, I have an on-the-record interview with the very intelligent and charming CEO of Royal Caribbean. And he talked about all of these and said that's the key to a lot of the key to their profitability, as well as, of course, the fact that people have fun on their ships. But for instance, a waiter is paid $50 a month and has to pay for their flights to and from Miami to pick up the ships. And that's allowed because the American labor laws don't apply to them. And that goes on with environment.
Of course, they get tips as well.
Well, they get tips as well. In fact, you when you get on the ships, either of you been on a cruise?
Yeah.
No. I have.
No?
You tip at the end.
Right, and you're given a form to tip, and it's made quite clear that if you don't tip, these people aren't going to be paid. And that's beyond tipping. That's like you are subsidizing their wages. And then this, of course, would not be allowed in any other kind of situation. And then, of course, there's the whole environmental issue. And I have all the statistics from the Environmental Protection Agency to show just what kind of what's left in the sea from these ships, because once they get past the 20 or so mile limit, then, you know, there's no international navy to enforce any kind of rules. So, like, in the course of a day, a cruise ship would drop out 21,000 gallons of sewage and human sewage and 170,000 gallons of wastewater from showers, et cetera, et cetera. And whether or not they have how clean that garbage is by the time you get into water is anybody's guess, because they do not have to report it.
Do you see any solutions at hand for this? I mean, can restrictions be put in place?
Well, members of Congress have tried regularly, and I show how much money the cruise ships pay lobbyists to make sure that that doesn't happen. Two states have really gone mano to mano on this. One is Alaska, and the other is California. And California has instituted some serious water and air, clean air and clean water rules that are relatively new. And Alaska has gone back and forth on this. One day they were able to, you know, 1 year they'd have stricter water rules, and the next it'll be overthrown by state legislature. It's a constant battle. But the overall trend is to enforce greater rules. In the Winter Olympics at Vancouver, a lot of cruise ships wanted to go and dock and act as, you know, hotels there. Just dock, and they would be a hotel for visitors. And the city of Vancouver said, okay, fine, but if you come here, you're going to have to use electricity for your power source, not your engines, because the fuel you use is so foul.
Right.
And like Venice is complaining about this, and they're trying to get rid of cruise ships entirely, because one cruise ship, the engine fumes is the equivalent of something like 12,000 idling cars a day. Mm. And this is, you know, as you know, Venice has no cars. So it's being attacked from all different sides. But as you said, it's the fastest growing form because it is so inexpensive.
I was surprised to read in your book, Elizabeth, that Venice only has 60,000 residents, and yet they host 20 million visitors a year.
Yes,
that must not be too happy with the locals, except for a few of the merchants, I suppose.
No, and it's becoming it's really sad. I'd been to Venice before, and like everybody, I think it's a masterpiece. It's just beautiful. But when you visit it with the locals who are trying to push back against the overwhelming tourism, you see a totally different city. It's there's so much tourism, and there's so much illegal opening up of the city to tourists that it's almost impossible to imagine a solution. The city authorities turn the other way when people open up their houses illegally to tourists. The zoning rules, like in Miami, you know where a hotel is and you know where your residential areas are. That's disappearing in Venice because people are renting out their houses. You know, they're not happy with the whole concept of the Airbnb Craigslist approach to renting out rooms where it should be a residential area, because they're losing their residential space. So bakeries are disappearing, clinics are disappearing, schools are disappearing because the locals are being pushed out. They can't afford the rent. They can't go up against international firms that are trying to take away the local shops. You know, on and on. And they say they're turning into a theme park. And people should beware. The more beautiful you are, the more you should fear.
Our telephone number, if you'd like to join in, we're speaking with Elizabeth Becker about her book, Overbooked. And our number is 1-800-743-9576. 1-800-743-WLRN. Also email, that's radio@WLRN.org. And also tweet is at Topical Currents. Elizabeth, let's briefly touch on dark tourism.
That grabbed me too. As you said, just about everything can be made in a tour package, and believe it or not, this dark tourism are tour packages of sites of genocide. Their tour package would include, of course, Europe, Auschwitz, and other sites of the Holocaust. Also possibly Rwanda, Sierra Leone, and then Cambodia and the killing fields. And that's where I came across it most strongly. The Minister of Tourism said he believes that that's the key to a lot of tourism develop in that country. In fact, they promoted it so much that Tuol Sleng, the former torture center, the Khmer Rouge, is now the most popular tourism site in the capital of Phnom Penh for foreigners. Just beyond the Royal Palace, all these gorgeous sites, it's now the foreigners are more likely to go to this torture center than any other spot. And it's it can be very exploitative, very gruesome. Now, some people say this is a good way to raise people's consciousness. I didn't quite see it that way, but maybe some people do. But it smacks in many ways. On many of these tour packages that I looked at, it looked pretty just ghoulish.
So you have never, I mean, I know you did a lot about the Khmer Rouge and wrote a book about it and, you know, covered Cambodia, but you would never go to one of these dark tourist attractions.
Oh, this was what was so queer is that I spent a lot of time doing research in tool slang for the book you mentioned, When the War Was Over, and I knew it as a resource for scholars, and in the olden days, it was Cambodians who went to it, Cambodians who had suffered under it. Now you almost never see Cambodians there. You see foreigners, and I'm not saying I wouldn't go there. I'm just saying that, places like the Holocaust Museum here in Washington, they are very thoughtful commemorations of what happened with a very strong sense of dignity for the victims. I got none of that from a lot of these things. It was just, scare you.
And what about sex tourism? How big is that?
Well, it would take you 5 minutes on the internet to realize how huge it is. It's just exploding with globalization. Once those borders are open, not only does it mean we can all travel, but it means that the lowlifes will also be able to do trafficking in underage women for sex tourism, and it's just exploding everywhere. The Caribbean, in Asia, in lots of parts of Europe. It's become a cri de coeur for a lot of activists to try to help stop it. But it's particularly difficult when you meet the underage girls who've been sold to brothels by their parents who are too poor to figure out any other way to do things, or others who were stolen from their country and taken to a brothel in another country. And their lives are ruined by the time they're 18 or 19.
And there's no really, it's very difficult to enforce them.
Well,
because of the poverty involved. And
right, and it's also because, the State Department has a wonderful program, a hotline. National governments have these wonderful programs in theory, but it requires policing and punishment, which means a clean police force and a clean judicial system, and the absence of bribes and so on and so forth, whereas this is an incredibly lucrative business, and it's very easy to bribe here, bribe there. And also, tourists are part of the problem. All the surveys I saw showed that tourists actually told the survey takers that they thought they were doing these young women a favor by spending the night with them and giving them $50.
Helping to support them, you mean?
Yeah.
Many of these sex trips begin online. Mm-hmm. Are officials at least trolling to see who's responding or who's inquiring about these underage sex partners?
Well, you can't. There's all kinds of, apparently, these chats, you use a kind of language that is not explicit per se. And but the enforcement has to be done in the country. So I saw several documentaries of different groups that try to track them down. And there are religious groups that work in foreign countries to help tracking down the men and trying to either catch humiliate them and so on and so forth. But it's without that strong enforcement by that foreign country, is not going to work particularly well.
We're speaking with Elizabeth Becker. She's an award-winning author and journalist, and her latest book is Overbooked: The Exploding Business of Travel and Tourism. If you want to join in the conversation, the number is 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-9576. You can email radio at WLRN.org, or you can tweet us at Topical Currents.
And let's take a call. This is Pete. He's in Homestead. Hey, Pete.
Hello. Hi, am I on the air?
Yes, you are.
Good. I have a question for your guest. I know that she's discussed how the ship companies, the cruise companies, escape environmental laws by the way their ships are registered. I'd like her to talk about safety also, because I understand by registering these ships in other countries like Liberia or wherever, rather than the U.S., they escape all of the safety regulations, which relate to some of the tragic accidents we've had. So I'll take my answer off the air. I mean, off the telephone. I'll hang up and, yeah, and listen on the air.
Thanks, Pete.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you, Pete. Thank you for reminding me of that. Yes. That is the case, and this is one instance where Congress has been stepping in lately, including former Senator, now Secretary of State John Kerry, who passed a recent law to just enforce one or two aspects of higher guardrails so people don't fall over, and better screening so to reduce the number of rapes. But yes, you're totally right, and a lot of the basic safety rules are ignored. And you see this in increasing amounts of accidents, whether it's the Italian cruise ship that drowned, that capsized, or the recent Carnival cruise ship in the Gulf of Mexico that went, that was stranded for several days. And if you look closely at all of the little news articles, you'll see people missing. They fall overboard, and there just aren't enough. Members of Congress are starting to say there's not enough safety, and that is because the families of people who lost family members on cruise ships have become a pretty serious lobby up here in Washington.
I'm surprised that they let them do this thing with the taxes. I mean, that's so much money that we're not getting.
Well, as we speak, of course, the Senate is looking at all of those law, all the loopholes, and trying to streamline the tax code, because we've got decades. And whenever something like just the cruise ship is looked at, your attention moves someplace else. So now they're starting to look at the whole thing. I don't know if it's going to be included or not.
So you mentioned Venice as one of the places that's had, you know, the worst impact from tourism. What are some other cities, and how can we travel to places like Venice responsibly?
Well, there's the classic solutions are still good. Travel of the off season, go off hours, and added to that, now, in particular, you should do a lot more homework before you go to figure out where you're going, so you don't just fall into all the usual tourist traps. Strongly recommending reading history books, studying language, you know, like the olden days when people took foreign travel seriously. But also take longer trips and make fewer of them, so that it's shown that if you go someplace for longer, you tend to spend proportionately much more in the local economy, and you're much more respectful of the local economy. I was just in New Orleans at the French Quarter, and it's experiencing some of the problems of Venice, where it's the mecca for all of the tourism into the city. A lot of people very illegally rent out parts of their houses. It looks like a frat party on steroids, with drunken, lousy, loud tourists all through the night, yeah, vomiting on people's doorsteps. And they're trying to figure out, you know, how to corral all this. And so the obvious thing is not to act like a adolescent let loose for their first holiday, which is what a lot of people do. I mean, behave respectfully and responsibly, which makes me sound like an old scold, but that's the way a conscientious tourist does. You know, don't do things there that you wouldn't do in your own community.
Elizabeth, I've been to Hong Kong a couple of times, and it's a city that makes New York City look laid back. But I was surprised to find that it outpaces Las Vegas in tourist revenues.
Yes, and this shows the gravitational pull of Asia. China, you know, it's the gateway to China. the Chinese go there for shopping, and we foreigners go there on our way to China. It's extraordinary for the nightlife, for the extraordinary Chinese dynamism there, and with more Western comforts than you find in most of China. And now, in the last decade or so, it's so close to Macau, which is now the world's biggest casino destination, outstripping Las Vegas, because all the big wagers, billions of dollars of wagers, are being spent there rather than in Las Vegas.
And why is that?
The Chinese are traditionally the biggest, traditionally, it's in their culture to gamble. And gambling was outlawed during the Communist Revolution's years. And Macau, as a Portuguese, former Portuguese colony, was the Monte Carlo of China. And it was just sort of sitting there with restrictions. And then with the opening of China under Deng Xiaoping in the 1980s, the country starts to open up, and eventually so does Macau. So now, for the first time in 70, 80 years, there is a Chinese spot in Macau for gambling, and you get extraordinary amounts of money spent there. The big wigs of Las Vegas have moved. Steve Wynn, Reed Abelson, they have huge casinos in in Macau now, because that's where the gamblers are.
Pat in Tamarack wants to know if you think people should travel independently rather than on tours. She feels that she can interact with locals and have more authentic experience when she travels on her own. I can have total control and responsibility of all aspects of my travel experience. What do you think of that?
Yes, she's right. There's nothing better than, you know, having a tour guide for half a day or a day or two. But yeah, when you travel independently, you definitely do, and you definitely meet more of the locals. and she's also pinpointed one of the problems with a lot of tours is that the only locals you meet are the waiters at the restaurant and the housekeepers who've changed your bed. And that's we all say we want to go overseas to see a foreign culture, but more often than not, we don't. We just see other tourists.
Taking public transportation with the rest of the population is very interesting also.
Mm-hmm. And, a Parisian subway, a bus in London, the subway in Madrid. It's always, and you learn so much just reading the signs. I was amazed that in Madrid, every day there was a new poem posted on the subway cars.
A new poem?
Poem.
Oh, yes. That's interesting.
Yeah. You, as you said, you pick up so many clues the closer you get to the culture.
We're speaking with Elizabeth Becker. She's an award-winning author and journalist, former New York Times correspondent, and was senior editor, foreign editor at NPR. And her newest book is Overbooked. We'll take one more short break on Topical Currents, and we'll be back.
And this is Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN, South Florida's NPR news station, and 91.5 WKWM NPR for the Florida Keys. Overcast skies, 87 degrees currently in Miami, a 50% chance of scattered thunderstorms the rest of the afternoon. We're funded by listeners like you and by Fair to Remember, a full-service off-premise catering company committed to making your event memorable anywhere in South Florida. Details on scheduling your event at 786-250-5387 and at fairtoremember.com.
If you're having a hard time selling that old car or truck or just don't want the bother of selling it, the WLRN Vehicle Donation Program can help. Just call 877-WLRN-CAR, 877-957-6227, or donate online at WLRN.org. Donating is easy when the tow truck comes to your home and picks up the vehicle. They give you the paperwork that you'll need and relieve the stress of what to do with the old car that just won't sell. That's 877-WLRN-CAR or donate online at WLRN.org.
And it is today's Topical Currents, Monday edition. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, Elizabeth Becker. Elizabeth, how about a website where people can learn more about you and your books?
It's www.elizabethbecker.com. Thanks for asking.
And we'll have a link to your website and to your book on the WLRN homepage and Topical Currents.
I have to say, just a shout out to Carl Hiaasen, your wonderful Florida author. He was one of the first writers who put it in my head that tourism wasn't 100% always cool. If you notice that, you know, tourism is almost a villain in some of his mysteries. And that's one of the reasons I started to say, why is he so angry at tourism? And then, of course, another author like that was Donna Leon, who writes mysteries about Venice. And both, of course, is no accident. They're both in the huge centers of tourism in the world.
Interesting.
I guess big in the tourism side would be Mark Twain.
Yes, and in fact, I quote Mark Twain and, you know, Innocents Abroad, because that was one of the first, he's such an amazing man, such a genius, but he's the first one to look at tourism from all sides. You know, he fell in love with France, but he saw the problems with the industry and sort of gave an outline of where it might go. And
where it went.
Yes, exactly.
So what are some countries or cities that are preserving their cultures and landscapes from over-exploitation? What are some notable ones?
Well, close to home is Costa Rica. And they're the pioneer of ecotourism. And it made total sense because they were not industrial power. They weren't a big agricultural state, but they had these gorgeous wildernesses. So more than half the country is now protected wilderness, and they have created this very solid tourism industry that enriches the local economy. Too often, countries that try to use tourism to pull out of poverty, the money doesn't stay in the country. It goes to the international hotel chain, it goes to the airplane companies, and so on and so forth. They figured out how to keep the money in the country with local eco lodges, resorts, that sort of thing, and at the same time use that tourism money to protect their wilderness. And it's got problems like anything else does, but it is it shows that it can work. And they have helped create a strong, vibrant middle class. Another, in the United States, of course, the great monument to smart tourism are national park systems. They are copied around the world. People come to study it because we've used our national parks, which we invented, to protect our wilderness and also to have a lot more people understand wilderness that wouldn't without the parks. And it spreads over to Africa. And there are a lot of African countries that are now doing a very good job with their wildlife parks and tourism. In Asia, Thailand is is one of the oldest tour destinations, and they are moving away from the package tour and the cement hotels on the beach to travel and tourism that is much more about Thailand and protecting in Thailand. And then the big one is that way is Bhutan, which is very strong protection of their culture and their forests. And they control tourism by watching the number of hotels that are built, so that there's a certain capacity, and you cannot get a visa if that would be going over the capacity. So there's many different ways to go at this, but it's all about a government that understands the good and the difficult of tourism and figures out how to use it in a way that enriches the culture and the citizens, which is hard. It's really hard, and it requires a lot of painstaking, really boring work.
I know many South Floridians, they really want no part of South Beach here. They just, stay away.
And anyway, it goes against greed, which is probably a big motivating factor in a lot of these countries that are being destroyed or cities that are being destroyed.
Well, there's something in the industry called the sacrifice zone. So, for instance, Belize. I talk about Belize, which has amazing barrier reef. reef and great wildlife. And there's certain parts of a wild of one of their parks where they allow cruise ship passengers to visit because they know it's already trashed. They let them go there, and then that leaves the rest of the park free of the hordes who come in and trample and leave garbage and stuff, and that way they protect it. So consciously or not, there are a lot of sacrifice zones within the tourism world where, okay, the hordes can go here and we're going to protect everything else from them.
What do travel journalists contribute? Are they helping or hindering the problems?
Again, I started in Miami to talk about that. The Miami Herald pioneered covering travel and tourism as an industry. And I mentioned Tom Fiedler, the old executive editor, and Doug Hanks, and some really great reporting. But overall, travel and tourism is treated as a lifestyle issue, not a business issue. And that's one of the reasons I wrote this book, because it's the first book-length look at global tourism and as an industry and where it's changing us. Travel and tourism, if you look at most of those sections, it's where to go,
right,
what to wear, what to eat, totally out of context. So that it's like this other world. You know, you have the real world and then you have the travel and tourism world where nothing ever goes wrong. You can drink and eat as much as you want. You can shop. You can dance.
And, of course, the reporters are comped.
And they're totally comped. And in some countries, you have to say that you're comped, and you know, meaning that you get everything for free. And I quote all these travel writers who fight for these free trips and never mention that it's free. And I said to one, but don't you think you're compromised? Oh, no. I always speak the truth. And I said, have you ever written anything negative about any place you've been? And she said, no. Mm. It's so wrong. Now, places like the New York Times, my old newspaper, and Condé Nast Traveler will not allow that, but they're few and far between. And you don't know if, when you're reading an article, if the writer has been paid by the industry, but odds are they have. And you certainly don't have the kind of travel and tourism writing we used to have where it was put in context, where you'd read a piece about South Africa and the writer would say, this country is under apartheid rules and blah, 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 blah. It's like another world that doesn't really exist nowadays when you read those.
We only have, we have a couple of minutes, Elizabeth. So do you think it's possible to turn tourism to something more beneficial than destructive? I mean, do you think we can do that?
Oh, absolutely. And that's why for every difficult, every bad example, I give a good example. It is possible. But you have to start thinking this way, that this is an industry, and like any industry, it needs the respect due to a big industry. It pulled us out of the Great Recession in many respects. But like any big industry, it really has to be regulated, and it has to be done in a complete, thorough way. And go to certain countries that do that. And yes, you can, but we're dealing with a global population of over 7 billion now, and tourism trips of 1 billion in foreign and possibly 3 billion in domestic. Mm. It cries out for that kind of understanding and that kind of regulation.
Where would you like to go that you haven't been?
Oh, I want to go to Antarctica.
Oh.
And... that the one thing I discovered writing this book is that I had really not a great appreciation for wilderness, and Africa knocked my socks off. I couldn't believe that I had been so narrow-minded before. And so now I've got the taste. I want to go to someplace like Antarctica and see the penguins. And that's another good story. The various governments in charge of rules and regulations of Antarctica have banned most cruise ships. Only the very small, highly environmentally regulated cruise ships can go there because they said, considering what's been going on, if one cruise ship had an accident and spilled oil, that fragile landscape would be destroyed. Mm. So people are taking their cues.
Yeah, and they're thinking ahead.
Yes, they are. And
well,
I hope
it's certainly been a pleasure, a very enjoyable hour. We've been speaking with journalist and author Elizabeth Becker, and her latest book is Overbooked, The Exploding Business of Travel and Tourism. Thanks for spending some time with us, Elizabeth.
Oh, thank you. I enjoyed it.
Thanks very much.
Apologies to those callers we couldn't get on. Our producer is Richard Ives. Technical direction from Caroline Brader Watts. Paul Leary is online producer. Tomorrow's program addresses the quandary of the Miami-Dade property appraiser. An elected official, must he still follow directives from the county commission? Also, frequent contributor Dan Ricker, publisher of The Watchdog Report. Find free audio archives and downloads at our website, WLRN.org. Also, the Topical Currents Facebook page has author and book links, including today's discussion and much more. And to the calendar on this day in 1863, 150 years ago, the start of the Battle of Gettysburg, the Civil War's largest. Generals Lee and Meade commanded Confederate and Union armies. Coupled with the fall of Vicksburg on July 4th, it was the turning point of the war. And on this day in 1910, 113 years ago, Duncan Black and Alonzo Decker opened a machine shop in Baltimore. They developed the first portable electric drill. One more while we remember C.J. Parker and Baywatch. On this day in 1967, 46 years ago, the birth of, well, actress Pamela Anderson in Ladysmith, British Columbia. She was discovered when shown wearing a Labatt t-shirt on a stadium megascreen at a B.C. Lions football game. Theme music created by Michael Levine. So we leave with words from Pamela Anderson of Finnish and Russian descent. It's great being blonde. With such low expectations, it's easy to impress. Joseph Cooper along with Bonnie Berman. Stand by next for our first edition of Here and Now from NPR News.
This is 91.